just a real quick comment since I do have a lot of time. Okay. I'm going to put back the five stories back into the message now. No, seriously, John Velasquez's points, I can't emphasize that enough about planning for the feast. I realize things are tough, and I was in the financial services industry. I'm going to tell you right now, put something away. It doesn't matter what it is, as close as you can to your second tithe, and do not touch it. Don't touch it. I know it's difficult. I know it is. I'm telling you now, I've been through it. I remember in years past, this does go back 30, 40 years, people in the church in the Pasadena area, do you know what they do at the local banks? They would go to local banks and set up Christmas accounts because of the special nature of those types of accounts. And they were kind of locked away, and they were for Christmas. And I remember one person told me, I said, what do you do when you go in? I said, I want to set up an account. I can't touch it, blah, blah, blah. Oh, our Christmas account. And he said, well, I'm not going to call it that. And they didn't use it for Christmas. They obviously used it for the feast. He called it a feast account. In fact, in our statement, we have something, it's called a feast account. Once again, I realize I know it's very difficult in these times. Also, to add to what Dr. Lewis and Mr. Hillegy said, these fires in California, I'm a native Californian, and we heard today on the way in, there's almost 40 people that have died, 200 or more that are missing, and 200,000 acres. It is truly a tragedy. So, and there's many people we met with in Oceanside who either have friends or do live in the Bay Area, so we cannot again say enough to say prayers for them. We had people were giving us prayers because there was the Anaheim Hills fire, I think many of you saw, and that was 8 miles from our home. And it was always interesting, I think in many marriages, there's one person who worries endlessly, and there's the other, the mate, who doesn't worry at all. You're looking at the mate that worries endlessly. I worry about not worrying enough. So I said to Becky, should we call the lady who's watching our house about the fire? She said, no, it's going to be okay. Becky, have you seen these maps and these videos? It's okay. So I trusted God and Becky for the fires. In Oceanside, the theme I wanted to tell you, and it's going to probably come out in a lot of other messages and listening to John and his message, the theme in Oceanside was very, very interesting. And we had messages on over the rainbow, how to play tennis, and they all had a feast theme. One dude talked about cardboard. I'm not even sure where he was going with that. But many of the speakers in Oceanside talked personally. They talked about personal events in their life, and it was quite interesting. As you know, we, or may know, that we lost an elder and his wife in their 80s going to the feast, Mr. and Mrs. Levitt up in Canada. And unfortunately, we also lost John Seforek during the feast. I'm not sure if you knew about that. John was a very, very good friend, and he suffered, I think, pretty similar to the fate my mother did. Basically post-operative or during the operation. John, the memories of John Seforek, ask you also to pray for him as well, or pray for his family now. So we've lost him. It was a very personal, with trials and the tribulations that we have in this very temporary life. And it's a pleasure to speak before you again. I'll give you greetings from Oceanside. Yo, dude. And I had a question for John. I know what Puerto Rico means. It means rich port. What does Vallarta mean? Does anybody know? Sweating? Mr. Brown. Yes, sir. Passage? Oh, the mountains. It's on the coast, isn't it? It's mountains on the coast. Okay, interesting. Thank you. So, in thinking of a message for you after the feast, and it's only been a couple of days, I know as John did, you think of who the audience is going to be. And we knew it would be a little smaller because people are still traveling. I note, Mr. Helge, I wanted to let you know, I note that Mr. Budge and Mr. Fish are not here. I will tell you that I did get a text from Mr. Budge, and he found the temple. I've got to read it here. He says the temple of Dionysus and their following was quite intriguing. All he says is he's going to check it out. I'm not sure what that meant, but he might be delayed. I'm kidding, of course. Mr. Fish and Mr. Budge and quite a few others went to Greece. But we have people who, anybody here that went to Greece? Oh, you made it back. Oh, okay. So we'll rib them about that when we see them. But in thinking of the group, and for various reasons, many people were unable to go to the feast. I'll tell you, in Oceanside, and I think there are in many feast sites, we had a table full of cards for people. You know the big ones? There was a, no pun intended, an ocean of cards for people to sign to send back to people who could not make it to the feast. So I thought of who the audience would be, and I said on Sabbath, let's create a little bit of the feast environment. And in fact, we're going to specifically talk about a very highly specific time. The Feast of Tabernacles, as you know, we will not turn to Leviticus chapter 23, because we all read it numerous times during the feast. That is what proclaims the feast of God, especially the Feast of Tabernacles and the eighth day, which are so important. It pictures a number of things. Both in the Old Testament, it pictures the wandering of Israel in tabernacles and tents for 40 years. In the New Testament, it is the thousand-year millennium, which ushers in the eighth day, and it has all that typology. And we try and cover that, many of the speakers do, during the time we have together. But the longest uninterrupted section in the entire New Testament is in the Gospels, and it's in the book of John. And I'd like you to turn, if you would, to John chapter 7. Now, because this is the righteous group that has made it back from the feast, right? We know you are devotees of your Bible. We're going to be reading a fascinating account of the Feast of Tabernacles. It is the longest, uninterrupted, continuous section in the New Testament of these days. In fact, in the academic literature, it has a very special name in the book of John. It's known as the Tabernacle Discourse, and it is commented on heavily. In one of the sessions we had in Oceanside for the Feast of Tabernacles, we had, I guess we call it a focus study. It wasn't really a Bible study. But we had during that, it was, how do we see the Feast of Tabernacles, a Christological view? In other words, how do we see the Feast of Tabernacles through the eyes of Jesus Christ? And we attempted, went a little long, but we attempted to remind ourselves of perspective. And we did that for a reason, because we discussed the Jesus in his pre-incarnate state all the way to the eighth day. But here, discuss with you the week-long feast of or during Jesus' life on earth. And it is indeed very special. So today, I'd like to discuss with you an important series of declarations during the Feast of Tabernacles by Jesus Christ. They're often overlooked in the reading. And so the title is Tabernacles, Water, and Light. Now, we are going to do some reading. Instead of doing 20, 30 verses all over the Bible, I'm lazy. We're going to do it in context. But it is a quick read, but it's very, very important. And we'll see a number of very interesting exchanges that Jesus had. And I want you to remember that this is during the Feast of Tabernacles. And we think that this was Jesus' possibly his last Feast of Tabernacles. His ministry was drawing to an end. So as a human being, keep this in mind as we read this, because the story flows very, very well. He knew his mission. He knew his timetable. He knew the clock was running, and he knew what the end would be. So let's read. Let's begin this. Yeah, this thing is dangerous. I thought of the same thing Mr. Helge did when I heard the bump. I said, shots fired. No, I'm not going to do that. Chapter 7 and verse 1. After these things, talking about the prior chapter, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. For he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. We will see this theme over and over and over again. The Jews sought to kill him throughout this chapter. His brothers therefore said to him, now the Jews' feast of, important verse, verse 2. Now the Jews' feast of tabernacles was at hand. It was coming up. His brothers therefore said to him, depart from here and go into Judea, primarily Jerusalem, that your disciples may also see the works that you are doing. That sounds very positive, doesn't it? His brothers are encouraging him. No, they're not. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. Here's the kicker, verse 5. For even his brothers did not believe in him. So the commentators, and it's very obvious, they said this with sarcasm. Go show yourselves. Why don't you go to Jerusalem? It's the feast. Everybody's going to be there. Show yourself to them. You want to make yourself known. And so we see this And we'll note, I think, a growing frustration with Jesus. Jesus was from God, but he came as a human being with all the emotions and inner workings that you and I have. And we'll see this, and we'll see exactly the context of why he says the things that he does, the way that he says them, in the manner that he does them. And so the time is the week we just completed. It's now fall. The feast is near. His brothers have said, oh, go to Judea. In fact, they would say they would go up to Jerusalem. And I know many of you, I have not gone to Jerusalem. And you go up in elevation to Jerusalem. And this was one of the pilgrimage feasts, so we know that there were many, many people there. And so, begin the series in verse 6, continuing the series in verse 6. Jesus said to them, the antecedent here is the brothers, my time has not yet come. Your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify of it that its works are evil. You go up to this feast. I am not going up to this feast yet, for my time has not yet fully come. When he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee for a time. We don't know what the time period of going up to Jerusalem. We can guess from where they were, how long it would take. But Jesus says very quickly, my time's not yet. I'm on a schedule. He says, you go on up. And as we know what happens, he says he remained in Galilee for a time. However, verse 10, it says, but when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it was in secret. So Jesus did exactly the opposite of what they recommended he do. Make yourself known. Make it publicly known. Jesus said, you go on up. And he followed later, but he did it secretly. He did not make fanfare. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, where is he? Because they knew he would be coming. And there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said, he is good. Others said, no, on the contrary, he deceives the people. However, no one spoke openly of him, for, here's that phrase again and again and again, no one spoke openly of Jesus for fear of the Jews. He was a marked man. Remember, if this was at the very end of his ministry, it was getting very heated, very confrontational. But Jesus goes up in secret. He knows there is a timetable. The interesting supposition, and this is supposition, is Jesus knew that if he provoked them too much, he would precipitate a reaction. And he didn't want that final reaction until, as we know, to fulfill the Passover season. And so no one would speak about Jesus because of fear of the Jews. So this is very interesting. So we see the crowd is divided. There are people that are in favor of what Jesus is saying. There are people that are divided. They're arguing among one another. Who is this person? As we'll see, it gets even worse. And so verse 14, we're going to read a longer section here. Verse 14, now about the middle of the feast, possibly, we do not know, possibly a Sabbath, Jesus went up into the temple and taught. And the Jews marveled, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? He had no formal rabbinic training that we know of. How does he know these things? Now note where he is. He's in the temple or the temple precincts. It's in the middle of the feast, possibly a Sabbath, as we'll see. They're still arguing. Verse 16. Jesus answered them and said, my doctrine, my teaching is not mine, but is his who sent me. If anyone wills to do his will, he shall know concerning that teaching, whether it is from God or whether I speak of my own. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory, but he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. Did not Moses give you the law? Talk about inflammatory language. Did not Moses give you the law, yet none of you keeps the law? Why do you seek to kill me? Oh, boy. So Jesus comes out with both barrels blazing. Remember where he is and when it is. It's in the middle of the feast, and he's in the temple precincts, and he is confronting the Jews, typically the Jewish leaders. How does this man know these things? He's not trained in any of this. We are. And he says, basically, his teaching, his doctrine is from God. That must have made them really happy, really pleasant. And so it goes on. Why do you seek to kill me? Verse 20, the people answered and said, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? Jesus answered and said to them, I did one work, and you all marvel. Moses therefore gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath so that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? The supposition is here is that in the oral teachings, they were permitted to break the Sabbath with work of circumcision to fulfill the eighth-day circumcision requirement. Jesus, we think, had a healing that we are not told of here, but that possibly he had a healing on the Sabbath. Therefore, he says, so that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? And we know from other instances in the Gospels that Jesus seemingly waited for the Sabbath to heal people. Remember the woman that had the issue of blood? He says, on the Sabbath day you loose your animals. Should not this daughter of Abraham, if you remember the story, this daughter of Abraham is loosed or released on the Sabbath. So he says, verse 24, do not judge according to what you see, what appears, but judge with righteous judgment. And the implication is what you saw was not what was intended. What you need to look at is the righteousness that he did on that day, that he healed on the Sabbath, which is a good thing. In other words, if it's okay to circumcise to fulfill the law, should not healing on the Sabbath also be fulfillment? So he's already gotten into an altercation with them. It gets worse. The exchange here is fascinating. It kind of comes to a head. And because it's midweek and he's at the temple during the Feast of Tabernacles, this is ground zero. This is not Galilee. This is not in Beersheba. This is not far to the north. This is in Jerusalem. Of all places to go, every rabbi, every teacher, every Pharisee, Sadducee, so you see, would be there. Everybody would be there. It was an expected command as one of the three pilgrimage festivals, or during one of the three pilgrimage festivals. And so Jesus picks this time. He engages the Jews. And it's fascinating. It brings up the Sabbath and the law. He will continue to talk about this subject. And so verse 25. Now some of them from Jerusalem said, so these are locals, they said, is this not he whom they seek to kill? So this verifies and validates what Jesus said earlier. They are seeking to kill him. Who's trying to kill you? These people are trying to kill him. Now some of them from Jerusalem said, is this not he whom they seek to kill? But look, he speaks boldly, and they say nothing to him. Meaning, they're not able to confront him. They're not able to answer him. They're not able to respond to him adequately. Jesus is winning the argument. He speaks boldly, and they say nothing to him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is truly the Messiah? Do they realize who they are talking to? And shows just much, much more division and argumentation, that the crowd was basically of two different opinions. This is the Christ. No, this is not the Christ. This is a rabble-rouser, and we need to kill him. We need to take him out of the way. It is a fascinating exchange. Then Jesus, however, we know where this man is from, but when the Messiah, the Christ, comes, no one knows where he is from. Verse 28, then Jesus, again, picture where he is and what he now does. Then Jesus cries out. He is loudly proclaiming this next sentence as he taught in the temple, saying, you both know me and you know where I am from. And I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. Talk about a slapdown. You do not know him, but I know him, for I am from him, and he sent me. You'll notice what Jesus doesn't say in this section. He barely referenced it in the last exchange. He doesn't mention God's name. He doesn't say God. You know where I am from. He who sent me. You do not know him. I know him. I am from him. He sent me. So the implication is obvious. I am from God. God has sent me. I speak the words of God. Neither do you know him, nor do you know me, because you do not know God. So it's obvious he is extremely frustrated. And he calls them out. He takes a tremendous risk during the Feast of Tabernacles, because they will not hesitate. We see later in the spring, as you well know, during Passover, they've got no qualms about it. They'll take him, they'll arrest him, and they'll kill him without a decent trial. So Jesus cries out in the temple and says these things. It gets better. He says, therefore they sought to take him. These next verses are fascinating, I think. Read them as they're written. Therefore they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him, because his hour had not yet come. And many of the people believed in him and said, when the Messiah comes, will he do more signs than these which this one has done? This man has done. When Christ comes to the earth, will that person be any more than this person that we see now? How could he possibly be greater than the person that we see now? Verse 32. The Pharisees heard the crowd murmuring these things concerning him. So this is obviously a lot of people. They're murmuring. That's how we know they're Israelites. Okay, good. We just came through the Feast of Tabernacles, wandering in the wilderness, murmuring. Forget it. The Pharisees heard the crowd murmuring these things concerning him. And the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him. Now remember that word officers. Then Jesus said to them, I shall be with you a little while longer, and then I go to him who sent me. You will seek me and not find me, and where I am, you cannot come. Again, somewhat enigmatic words. He does not reference God. He says, I will only be here a little while longer. My clock will be over. My life will be at an end. This will all be over shortly. And he says, I will go to him, God, who sent me. You will seek me. You will not find me. And where I am, you cannot come. Remember who he is speaking to. Who is he speaking to? He is speaking to the Pharisees, chief priests, and officers. The two of them, again, the antecedent we just read. So he tells them very clearly who he is. I mean, again, I read, and I'm speculating, the word Jesus was frustrated is not there. But I think I can sense it. He is slowly confronting them. He is giving them both barrels. He is putting them down that they, all right, you're from God, you're not from God. If you were from God, you'd know God. If you knew God, you'd know me. You don't know anything. So highly confrontational. And being the observant and introspective people that they are, verse 35, fascinating verse. He says, then the Jews said among themselves, where does he intend to go that we shall not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks? That was what we call the diaspora. And those are the people that were no longer in Jerusalem or Israel proper, but they had migrated to other areas. We call that the diaspora to this day, dispersion here. Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks? Well, I guess we won't find him if he goes there. What is this thing? He said, you will seek me and not find me, and where I am, you cannot come. The point is, they understood none of it. So everything Jesus said to them was true. You don't get it. You don't understand. I've tried to explain it to you. But some of the people did understand. They understand him that he was the Christ, he was the Messiah, and that indeed he had come to earth. Notice that the Jews and the leaders are confused. And I believe that Jesus has had it. This is, we believe, his possibly last recorded feast. Now, let's step back from the text. Let's remember that this pictures tabernacles in the wilderness, Exodus. That's what Leviticus chapter 23 is very clear about. Tabernacles was to be celebrated to remind them of they tabernacled in the wilderness. We know that it also meant the millennium. So Exodus is the wilderness wandering, all through Exodus and Deuteronomy, and the millennium, Revelation chapter 20 and 21. In both cases, both these events, as we picture and we teach and we believe, in both cases, it pictures being with primarily, almost exclusively, not quite, the presence of Jesus Christ in the Old Testament and the presence of Jesus Christ in the millennium. And here we find Jesus in his third iteration, his third embodiment on earth. I want you to think of this through Jesus' eyes. Think of what he is going through. I came to man to be with them. I was with them before in the wilderness. I'm with them now. I will be with them in the resurrection and on into the millennium. What is Jesus thinking? He has got to be heartbroken in many ways, but he knows the prophecy. The human side of him has got to be frustrated. The divine side of him says, this is part of the timetable. This is all prophesied. This is what has to happen. So we can imagine Jesus in the flesh tabernacling with man this week, these pages, these verses. He's tabernacling during tabernacles, and it is his last. No wonder he felt the way he did. No wonder he said the things that he did. Now, during the Feast of Tabernacles in the first century, we don't have exact records. We have no concurrent records in any of the Jewish writings of the Feast of Tabernacles. So we don't have a lot of detail. We have some ideas what went on. But one of the things we do have is we do have written records of what we think was occurring during this first century. Throughout most of the feast, there were three major ceremonies. And they, to one degree or another, still exist in form, though there is no temple. They exist in form today in most Orthodox, in fact, all Orthodox, in many conservative synagogues today. One was the daily prayer. It comes from Ezekiel chapter 8. They would pray this every morning. Our fathers, when they were in this place, turned their faces toward the east. This is the temple. And they worshiped the sun toward the east. But as for us, our eyes are turned toward the Lord. And they would recite this prayer every day during the Feast of Tabernacles. And I'm going to try my best Hebrew, which I'm probably going to butcher it. The next event was the Simchat Bet HaShoeviah, which is the water libation. It means the place or the dwelling where the water is given. Water, as you know, is extremely important during the wilderness wanderings. Deserts don't have water. That's why we call them deserts. And so water is a very, very precious thing. As you may know, out in Palm Springs, that's why it's called Palm Springs, is because there are, very good, springs. There are subterranean springs, and they bubble up, and that's where they settle, because that's, and they called it Palm Springs. And so the water motif or the water idea is extremely important during the Feast of Tabernacles. We know in 1 Corinthians 10, it says that Christ was that rock. The water followed them. So water was a major, major theme. It's called the water libation or the Simchat Bet, the celebration of the house of the giving of water. And they did this for 7 days. Every morning, water by the priests would be carried from the river, the Siloam, or the pool of Siloam, up to the temple. With great pomp and ceremony, the type of vessels, the number of vessels, the amount of water was very important. Kid needs water. So this is important. Water is a major theme for the feast. So also with this was the third ceremony, was the lighting of the torches. Tall structures were built, and on top of them, torches were lifted up by successive, like an army of rabbis or men, all the way to the top. Every night, there would be torches at night. And this symbolized light and had, very picturesquely, it would talk about the pillar of fire and the cloud that led Israel during the wilderness. So this was another type of ceremony. The Mishnah, Tractate Sukkah, I know you're just dying to hear this, during this ceremony, states, he who has not seen the rejoicing at the place of the water drawing and all that accompanies it has never seen rejoicing in his life. And this was done every day during the Feast of Tabernacles, every one of the 7 days. Interesting side note, if you want to look this up, and you can Google the word water libation, and all of this will come up during the Feast of Tabernacles. There's many, many articles on it, both not so scholarly and some a little bit more serious. But what's interesting is this was held at the Temple Mount. And they have in the Temple Mount precinct something called the Court of Women, right? Women were separated at that time, and there was a wall. The women had to watch a lot of this from a partitioned area. I'm always fascinated when people say, let's go back to first century synagogues. And I'd say, well, we're going to have a big wall, and the ladies have got to be on the other side of that wall or not there. So be careful what you ask for. And so we know this was happening in some form or another throughout the week, all 7 days. Can you imagine every 7 days, this rejoicing, the fire and the water. On the seventh day of the feast, that last day of the Feast of Tabernacles, the water libation reached its climax. The priests circled the altar seven times, and every time they'd circle, they'd blow the shofar in a syncopated rhythm. The shofar sounding each time. They poured out the water with the great pomp, the great ceremony, and the seventh day was important. They called that day, it's called today that by that same term, they called that day Hoshana Rabbah. Hoshana Rabbah. Rabbah means great. R-A-B-B-A-H. And you can look that up as well. Google it. Hoshana Rabbah. That seventh day, that last day of the feast, is called the Great Supplication, or the Great Prayer for Salvation. And it's very important. And again, it's practiced and observed today. What's also interesting is the seven rounds that they made around the temple with the water on the seventh day was also supposed to give reminiscence to, does anybody have a clue? It's a small group. Make it audible. Jericho. It was a symbol of Jericho, which was connected to them going into the promised land after the wilderness wanderings. And so I invite you to look these things up. It's very easy to do. But we can easily see that this could have very easily existed in Jesus' day. So you have this water ceremony. You have the lighting ceremony. And it's important. And so we see, we bring this all the way down to verse 37. I want you to read carefully after seeing what he saw, more than likely, in his frustration. On the last day, that great one of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, saying, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." We think that's from Isaiah 44, verse 3. We need not turn there. But Jesus cries out. We see that phrase again. He cries out just as he did in verse 28. If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. You want water, I'm here. I will give you rivers of living water. But this he spoke concerning the Spirit, whom those believing in him would receive. For the Spirit was not yet, because Jesus was not yet glorified. That refers to what event? Day of Pentecost, another holy day. And so Jesus cries out, I believe, in great frustration, great emotion. He didn't stand there, brethren, and say, if anyone thirsts, have them come to me. No, he cries out, and he's in the temple precincts, for everyone to hear him, if anyone who believes in me. And so I believe he's just seen the water ceremony. He's watched it every day. They may have just circled seven times. He knows the light ceremony will soon be there. This guy is a party buster, right? He's a killjoy. What's really interesting, is he doesn't say anything against the ceremony. Not one word. Because he understood that this is very special to them. It's not commanded in Torah, in the law. But he says nothing against it. But what he does say, by comparison, you want water, come to me. Verse 40. Therefore, many from the crowd, when they heard this saying, said, many, not all, truly this is the prophet. Speaking of Genesis chapter 18, 16, where there shall arise a prophet, Moses said, there shall arise a prophet like unto me, him you will listen to. Truly this is the prophet. Others said, this is the Messiah. But some said, will the Messiah come out of Galilee? This is interesting. They're right back into source. Where did he come from? I thought we covered that. Will he come out of Galilee? Has not the scripture said that the Christ will come from the seed of David and from the town of Bethlehem, where David was? So there was a division among the people because of him. Now some of them wanted to take him, but no one laid hands on him. We see this over and over again. The word take him means to take him and to kill him. It goes on, verse 45. Then the officers came to the chief priests and Pharisees. Remember, they had sent them out. Came to the chief priests and Pharisees, who said to them, why have you not brought him? The officers said, no man ever spoke like this man. So even the officers of the court are completely taken over by Jesus. We've never heard anybody talk like this. Remember what the question was? Why haven't you brought him? The answer, this man's different. No one has ever spoken like this man. That's why we didn't take him. They were afraid of who they were taking. He says, or they say, no man ever spoke like this man. Then the Pharisees answered them, are you also deceived? Have any of the rulers or the Pharisees believed in him? Remember this question. Have any of the rulers or the Pharisees believed in him? But this crowd that does not know the law is accursed. That Jesus would be accursed because he professed blasphemy. Now remember the phrase, has anybody believed in him from the rulers of the Pharisees? Verse 50, Nicodemus. Who is Nicodemus? Who was he? Yeah, he was way up there. Nicodemus, he who came to Jesus by night, being one of them, said to them, so ironic, does our law judge a man before it hears him and knows what he is doing? Oh, if ever a sentence was given and fallen on deaf ears, it never happened. Nicodemus was quickly forgotten. The answer is, yes, we will judge a man before we hear him. But that's not what the law says. The law says we should hear a man before and know what he's doing. Verse 52, they answered and said to him, are you nuts? No, that's my translation. Are you also from Galilee? Remember that Galilee was considered a backwater area of Israel. It was bumpkins, country folk. Are you also stupid? A bumpkin? Search and look, for no prophet has arisen out of Galilee. I mean, you could see this exchange. They're even fighting among themselves now about who to believe. Jesus is even semi-influenced the officers that they sent out to arrest him. And so this is all during what day? The seventh day of the feast. And they're trying to kill Jesus during the Feast of Tabernacles. Doesn't quite work out because that's not the time clock. That's not his calendar. His calendar goes on for many more months. They just don't get it. These verses talk about the continued rejection, confusion, and arguing. Even after Nicodemus intervenes, they want nothing to do with him. They want him D-E-A-D, dead. Get rid of the guy, ignore him, and remove him. That's what they did permanently. Now, I'm going to throw you a slight curve here, but we're all friends. In verse 53, and then chapter 8, all the way to verse 11 of chapter 8, these verses seem to not belong. And indeed, I won't get into the manuscript or textual evidence, but we do have a textual issue. These verses here, everyone went to his house, and then it says verse 1, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. He then came again to the temple, and all the people came to him and sat down and taught them. Then it talks about the woman caught in adultery. In manuscript evidence, this section appears in over 900 manuscripts. The problem is they're known as Byzantine texts, hundreds and hundreds of years after the earlier manuscripts, which are known as Alexandrian. What's the point? They think this is indeed inspired, and indeed they find it elsewhere. It's just out of order in some manuscripts. So what I'm going to do is explain to you that this is a beautiful story of the woman taken in adultery. We know it very well. Verse 11 is obviously the verse 10 and 11. When Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman accused of adultery, he said to her, woman, where are those accusers of yours? No one has condemned you. She said, no one, Lord. Jesus said to her, neither do I condemn. Go and sin no more. And that's the important part of that section. However, if it is not a part of the original story, remember, most of the Gospels are sections of stories placed together slightly differently by different evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so I'm not saying this isn't inspired. I think it is. It just may be in the wrong place. But what we want to do is pick up the story after verse 52. They said, no prophet has arisen out of Galilee, and move to verse 12. It says, then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. I am the light of the world. The light of life. Follow me. There are other senses and ideas that we all know with the Feast of Tabernacles and the wandering of the wilderness. We're not only water, as we heard earlier, but light and fire. We're intimately related to this. So Jesus uses two themes that he knows have great importance with the Feast of Tabernacles, especially as it relates to the Old Testament picture of them wandering in the desert. So he uses this idea of true water, and he is the giver of that water, and he is the true light of this world. He says we do not walk in darkness. We should not walk in darkness, for we have the Spirit and its light. Do you know, during the Feast in Oceanside, Becky and I think she would agree, but all the 40-plus years we have observed the feast, I want to be near water. There's been a few feasts, they're all wonderful, but I love being near water. I remember going up to Lake Tahoe year after year after year for the Feast of Tabernacles. It was my very first feast. Second feast was in Tahoe. My first feast, I was young and stuck in Pasadena. But to go to Tahoe and that huge body of water gives me a sense of wonder in how big God is. When we go to Oceanside, and when we've gone to the East Coast, we spent many years on the East Coast, and we'd go to Hilton Head or Myrtle Beach. I like to be near water. The bigger, the better. And at Oceanside, as you know, because you've all seen the Pacific Ocean, that is technically the largest body of water on the planet. And to see that during the Feast of Tabernacles gives me a sense of just how big God is. And of course, nothing's more spectacular than sunset at the beach. And it was always a big event. It's amazing when we're blessed enough to stay near the beach and we've watched the sunset. I'm always amazed that it's like we've never seen a sunset before. But somehow during the feast, with the light and the water, it kept making me think of how important light and water is to us and how important it is to this section. Those of you that were in Greece, how many of you know what the green flash is? Did you notice? How many of you know what the green flash is, period? Yeah, and that's apparently only in Greece. We saw it. It's where the sun, the light of the day, ends at night. And as it hits the water, and give you the physics behind it, it's an achromatic inversion. But in any event, it's pretty. Where the sun, and there's a boom of a green flash at the very end. Water and light are essential for human beings. And this section in John 7 and 8 pictures the one who was with Israel in the wilderness and with man on earth. And we believe that it also pictures Jesus Christ with man for 1,000 years, to be ended on the eighth day with God and Christ being with man forever. On these days that picture God with man, Jesus cries out for people to understand the truth and to listen. So the question is indeed, before we wag our tongues at the Pharisees and the chief priests and just the other people of Jerusalem, do we get it? Do we understand it? We have these books. We get to read them in multiple languages and different versions. Do we get it? Do I get it? We see a lot of arguing and a lot of division. We seem to be surprised. It creates confusion. We seem to be even more surprised. This is the way of the world. It's a part of life. And God said, as with the days we just pictured, and I think Mr. Velasquez mentioned it, folks, it's going to get a lot worse. This will be, or this is, the good old days that we will pine for 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. It's at least semi-civil. But arguing and dividing, it's more than that, because amidst the noise and the confusion, and living in Southern California where we do, there's a lot of voices, there's a lot of activity, there's a lot of input on our senses. So our lives oftentimes reflect the world because we allow these things into our lives. I'm constantly told, since I have a little bit more free time, turn off the TV. And my family's right. I don't learn that much more watching TV for 16 hours straight. I don't. But you get the point. But amidst the noise and confusion of the world, our lives become impacted. Even during the feast, there are places to go, things to do, people to see, old friends to get reacquainted with, and those things are vitally important. Family, faith, and fun at the feast, the four F's. It's vitally important. However, sometimes we can forget. As Mr. Velasquez said again, we didn't partner on this, is that we had a lot of good activities. We saw a lot of good friends. But what did we learn? Not even during services. What did we learn after the service, before the service? What do we retain? Jesus says in these days that he tries to speak during these days. God, through Jesus Christ, speaks. He is, we believe, the true source of the water and therefore the Spirit. And that gives us a glimpse into the right way and what we are to do. He is the light of the world, and with that Spirit gives us clarity. He says for us to listen. He says for us to hear. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. He is the light in this very, very crazy and increasingly crazy world. Wherever you were during the feast in the eighth day, reflect on these things. Jesus should not be frustrated with us, because we agree and should agree. Recall, we are called to hear and to listen to the things in our lives differently. We have been given different equipment, different instruments to listen, to walk according to God's ways, to his laws, his paths, and with his timing and a sense of timing. Maybe not so rushed, maybe not so worried as Jesus Christ did. So during the feast, Jesus Christ cried out to be heard. In many ways, the entire 8 days pictures indeed a very temporary nature, especially marked by those who we did lose. But we have God in Christ in us and with us. And it tells us that one day these days do, one day we will dwell with them forever and ever.